Hi, everyone, and welcome. We're doing Parashas Vayakhel, which is actually really exciting. This is the moment we're beginning to gather the Jewish people together in order to build a Mishkan, to build the house of God. Now, we talked quite a bit about some of the elements of this in previous sedras. The most striking thing, however, about Vayakhel is that at least ostensibly, at least overtly, it doesn't seem to add a lot of new information. In fact, almost the entire Vayakhel could have been summed up in a single pasuk. It could have said, "Vayasu bnei Yisrael kasher tziva Hashem es Moshe." The Israelites did exactly as Moshe Hashem had commanded. Moshe kenasu bnei Yisrael, so they did, and they built the Mishkan. Right? We've had the intricate instructions already. So this raises a question of why there's so much apparently repetitive detail going through as to everything that's happening. But okay, but let's take a zoom back, right? And let's ask ourselves, let's look at this. Vayakhel Moshe, first of all, comes this gathering, right? The very name of the Sedra, Vayakhel, there's a gathering. This is critical. He gathers them all together. Now, normally, we just say Hashem told Moshe, and then Moshe tells the people and says, do this, right? Here, there's something different. There has to be an Hakola, some kind of major assembly. And Rashi points out just how dramatic this all was. This was the moment, the day after God had forgiven the people, given the second lot of the Luchos of the Ten Commandments. And now he gathers everybody together. Or Rashi says he causes them to gather together. And then the first thing he says actually is doesn't even mention that it's building the temple. He says you got to have keep Shabbos. 6 days you work, right? And the seventh day you can't do any work on it. And then, right, and that presumably is linked to the Mishkan, that you're going to build a house of God, do it for 6 days, but rest on the seventh. And in fact, of course, the juxtaposition means that we learn from here that Shabbos is in time what the Mishkan is, what the temple of God is in space. It's a temple in time. And this, of course, we learn across Melacha, right? That anything you could do to build a temple is exactly the things you can't do on Shabbos, right? So, well, you actively build the house of God. On Shabbos, you actively desist from, and that's how you build the house. Sometimes you bring God into the world by building, and sometimes you bring God into the world by not building, by letting go and letting his presence in. And Moshe's saying the latter, the seventh day, every time stopping, bring Hashem's presence, overrides the active, the former. It has to come first. So this is very significant, right? Here we have this notion, we've got to all gather together, which seems to indicate you cannot successfully build this Mishkan if you don't have two elements. Number one, a gathering of everybody together. And number two, the sensitivity of Shabbos, of knowing when to stop building. You build the house of God unless you know when you're not in control and you don't build. And you cannot build the house of God, even if it's lots of you contributing to the project, if you've not been gathered together. And the profundity of this is going to emerge soon as well. And then he says to the people that this is what Hashem commanded. Everybody should give gifts, all the different things, as we heard three weeks ago. And they all did that. And then he describes exactly how to build everything. And it's the most incredible. Everybody's contributing. Vayavoya says the pasuk in Lamedei 21, 35. Sorry, Lamedei Chof Aleph 35, 21. Vayavoya kolish asher nesali. But everybody's heart was being lifted. Kolish anod verucha. People's spirits are being lifted. They brought the trumas sham. They brought the gifts. They brought everything to the oil moed, to the tent of meeting, the cholav adasa, all the work, levigdei kodesh, all the things they brought. And everybody came and brought all their beautiful jewelries and all these various things. It lists out people just volunteering and giving their time, giving their gifts, giving their energies, giving absolutely everything they possibly could. This was a project where everybody had it in there, right? But all the men, what they did, all the women, what they did, everybody was doing all these things. And the Nesiim, the princes of the people, well, it describes how everybody brought these beautiful things. An absolutely beautiful piece of Torah over here. Kolish v'ish, every man and woman, asher nadav libam, whose hearts moved them, lahavi l'chol ha'melacha, shetziv Hashem la'aseis b'yad Moshe, ha'hevi'u b'nei Yisrael nadava. All that they were just, it's this beautiful sense of national giving, national contributing, national, everybody wanted to be there. And then we talk about who's going to construct and all the various things they're going to do. Everybody who had skills, every artisan and craftsman, they were all coming forward. Everybody was doing these things. And it ended up being too much, right? That's the end conclusion of all of this. But then, right, then we have the following. we get to a very long... There's not a lot of Rashi commentary on the Sedra this week. And the reason there's not a lot of commentary is because most things have already been explained, right? The Torah says they have to build the menorah, the candelabra. It's already been described already two Sedras ago, which again was the question we asked earlier. Why do we need this whole thing repeated in such detail? But there's one area where Rashi really develops a major discussion. And it's like this. It's in chapter 38 in Lamed Ches. And it's in Pasuk, really Zion. Well, let's have a look at what goes on over here. But Yahweh is about, sorry, but really the next one. But Yah says a kiar and a choshes. So it's Pasuk Ches, sorry, 8. They made the kiar. What is the kiar? Remember, the kiar is the wash basin. It wasn't even described in the original lot of temple vessels. It's something goes outside, but it's before you can do the service. The Kohanim have to purify, the priests have to purify their hands and legs before they can walk in and do anything. Okay. Vayas kiar nechoshes, they make this copper kiar wash basin. That's kanai nechoshes, right? And it's a base also. But Maro said Sovos, with the mirrors of the women Ashatsovu Pesach Oil Moed, who gathered themselves outside the entrance of the tent of meeting. What is going on over here? So, and what's the emphasis of what do we specifically mention? The one specific lot of gifts they made the kiar out of. And Rashi says that what happened is, he quotes the Medrash, which actually this ancient rabbinic teaching is in different places, where he says that the Jewish people, the women had these copper mirrors. What was the story? The story was they would beautify themselves. That's how Rashi describes it. And even then they gave for the contribution. But Moshe originally rejected them because he says, it's too much about beautification and ultimately about evil inclination, right? It's about temptation and lust and all sorts of things that shouldn't really be at the center point of the Mishkan, of the house of God. And then says Rashi, because Amalei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the creator of the universe, says to him, Kabel, accept them. These are more precious to me than all the other gifts. That's why we use the phrase tzovos, right? So this is the magic of saying tzovos. So what's tzovos mean? It's a strange word. See? In English, translations that will say things like congregated or literally means some kind of hosts or big population. This is how they populated the Jewish people. What happened? And now listen very carefully. Remember, it was crushing labor in Egypt. And the men had given up. On many levels, the men gave up. First of all, they were just physically exhausted. But also remember later on, they give up because they think Pharaoh's making a decree to kill all boys that are born. But the women carry on. They would go and bring them food, a mishnah and drink, and feed them. And then they would take the mirrors. And each one shows themselves and their husband in the mirror. They use words and say, look, I'm beautiful, I'm more beautiful than you. And that aroused in the passion in their husbands. And yes, they had relationships, they had children. That in Shir Shirim, in the Song of Songs, it uses the pasuk in the verse in the eighth chapter, says that under the apple tree, I aroused you, right? Which means, and there the Gemara and Sota, in Daf Yud Aleph Amud Beis, the Gemara and Sota says that the apple tree is really referring to the fields where they would go out to the husbands. It's referring back to Egypt. And that's it. So Hashem says, therefore, So Hashem says, Moshe, this is more precious to me than anything else. That's a different version of this medrash, but all of them have the same basic theme. And that's, and then it becomes, this becomes, kiar also amongst its other functions, wasn't just to wash their hands and feet every day, but it was also lasum shalom ben ish l'ishtoi, to make peace between a man and his wife. Why? Because in the case where there was suspected adulterers, they'd eat, drink from his water, and it would prove their innocence. Okay. But there's a lot going on over here. And I just want to really raise one major point that I think links together so much of what's happening. You see, in the interim, they served the golden calf. And really speaking, we have two sedras describing exactly how the House of Hashem has to be built in intricate detail. Then we had an interruption with the golden calf, and now we have two sedras of how it's actually built. Now, remember something we said in earlier sedras when we learned together? We said that according to Ramban, Nachmanides, that's exactly what happened. First at Sinai, God says, at Mount Sinai, Hashem says to Moshe, he says, I want you to build the temple for me. And he gives all the instructions. Then they serve the golden calf. Then Hashem forgives them. And then they actually go and build the temple. But according to Rashi, and according to many commentaries, actually, probably the majority, quite a strong majority, this is not chronologically what happened. Chronologically, there was no instruction of the temple. There was the giving of the Ten Commandments. 40 days Moshe's up the mountain to receive the Torah. In the meantime, they serve a golden calf. Moshe comes down. 80 days later, he secures forgiveness. Then Hashem instructs the commandment of the Mishkan, and then they carry it out. So the Torah violated chronology to shift the instruction to before the golden calf. And on a simple level here, but a very profound level, why would the Torah do that? Because, again, the Torah restructures itself around the way we have to serve Hashem. Okay? The Torah would often violate, according to the view of Ein Mukdum Mukhob Torah, there's no chronological order in Torah. There's a conceptual order instead. So we saw this when we learned Yisro, right? Yisro itself, according to many people, the Torah was given. And then Yisro, Moshe's father-in-law, came and said, one second, Moshe, you cannot stand in front of the people and you be the only person who communicates with them. You have to have a hierarchy of people can study under one and then under the other and then and climb up until they get to you or ask questions to the local rabbi, if you like, then go to the more senior ones until they come to you. So why do you put it there? Because after all the sins that we did, that's the only way for us to climb back up Mount Sinai. So the Torah took something from later, put it earlier because we need that stepping stone. We can't grasp, you know, Moshe's teachings or grasp the Torah. We need to go first to a teacher, to somebody who can give us the law, then that we can, is relatable enough that we can connect to. And when we've transcended them, we go to the next level up and the next level up and the next level up. That's how we, so we violated the chronology for the sake of giving you the conceptual order. In other words, so let's think, if we were telling a story the way the Torah tells it, imagine you have a coach comes and tries to teach a football team, right? And he teaches these amazing tactics that, but then he realizes they're not on this level. They cannot absorb it. So then the coach comes along and says, okay, fine, let's teach you now a little bit that, right, to the lower level. When we report the story, we may teach how he taught the lower level first and then teach how he taught the higher level, right? So in other words, even though in time he tried to teach the higher level first, then had to go down to the lower level, when we write the story of the, right, we'd write the lower level. We write the story, if it's an instruction manual, we'll say, look, here's how he taught you how to get from level A to B. Now let's tell you the story of the instructions to get from level B to C, or let's assume C is the higher level. That's what the Torah does. Okay, that's very nice for Har Sinai. What about here? Right, that's nice for receiving the Ten Commandments. And what about here? Here it's the same thing. Hashem wants to show you, first of all, a pure vision of the Mishkan, untainted by sin, right? That he wants to show you the Mishkan, in a certain sense, we should treat it after Sinai as the ideal. We don't have another way of preserving the revelation. We don't have another way of having God's presence among us through the long journey of history back to the Garden of Eden, except by first having a Mishkan, a place where God's presence can dwell. So we need to learn about that as that. We need to learn and understand that after Mount Sinai, the next thing we need to hear about is now we need a home, one place on earth where we can feel the full presence of God. Eventually, it can be everywhere. But first, has to be one place. Now we haven't even merited that. We're in exile from even that. But that's what we've got to strive for. Now comes the next bit, which is, what's the great, the golden calf? And all that we studied about the golden calf and the natural inclination to sin and all this kind of stuff. And then, and what it's teaching you now is the gap between the ideal and the action is a universe. In between the two lies the golden calf. So I'll give you an example. For example, you have a great idea. I have a great idea. We have wonderful inspiration to serve Hashem. We've got a clear vision of how to do it. To carry it out is not just carrying out that inspiration. To carry it out is to fight all the negative drives. The negative drives don't stop the inspired ideas. The negative drives try to convert inspired ideas into self-centered thinking. Right, as we spoke about the golden calf, we explained exactly what it was. It was the idea of replicating God with something they could relate to that could serve them. which on a subconscious level we do? What can we change a bit so I get something out of it? The gap between, so this is the point, is the gap between the elevated state of vision and action is where sin lies. And that means that the action is not just, oh, I did what I was instructed. The action is a whole work by itself. Work number one is constructing a vision. Work number two is an action. Every time they gave the gold, that wasn't just, I did what was told. There's a whole battle going on in that giving of the gold. And the Torah shouldn't just write or won't just write, oh, they did everything Moshe said. The Torah is going to, each detail they did, that was a battle. There was work involved in creating that, and they had to create that giving spirit. They had to create the giving spirit. It wasn't a given. There's a golden calf in the way. There's a desire not to have a giving spirit. There's a desire to serve themselves instead. And instead they transcended and they gave and they built the ark. And then they did something else and they built the menorah. And then they did something else. They each one is an achievement. If you just wrote, they did everything Moshe said, you think like, okay, that's the instruction. Okay, now they carried out. There's nothing more to it. But building the house of God is a battle. It's really, really hard. It isn't as simple as, I've studied the Torah, I know what to do, I just do it. That bit of keeping Torah is fine. It's when we study, we know what to do. But now we've got to confront every bit of us. We've got to confront our self-centered. If I keep this or I check, will I be unpopular socially? What will happen to my reputation in town? Will I still have friends? Will people say I've become too from? That's real work. And it's really, really hard to actually build the house of Hashem. To this day, it's very easy to learn the halachos, to learn all the laws of how to build a Mishkan. But we haven't succeeded for 2,000 years in overcoming enough of the challenges to actually build it. And Vayakhel shows us how to do it. The first thing is everyone together. And in fact, the element that Vayakhel adds that was not yet there are these mirrors. So how do these mirrors provide the answer? What was Moshe bothered by and what was Hashem answering him? Moshe understood and knew that the women had intended to have children. Moshe's own mother and his own sister told his parents, come on, Pharaoh's only making a decree against the men. You're not getting married. You're not living together means there's going to be no men or women. And that's why they came back together. And in fact, they ended up having Moshe. So Moshe's aware of this. The deep teaching over here and the deep thing that Hashem added that Moshe wasn't aware of. And this, I owe this insight into Rabbi Weinberg, whose share I heard this from many, many years ago in the old city of Jerusalem. A point that's emphasized every time Chazal raised this is when they showed the mirror, of the husband and wife together. When they looked in the mirror, they saw their husband with them. You see, the Gemara describes the question of a Nazir, right? A person who's a Nazirite who goes to a certain ascetic vow for 30 days, doesn't drink wine and doesn't cut their hair and so on. And generally, the Gemara's got, there's lots of different opinions of the Gemara. Is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing? And the Gemara talks about the one offering that I think Shimon HaTzadik was proud of the Nazirite offering. He saw a fellow who looked so beautiful, was bringing the offering, and he looked very beautiful. And he says, yes, the reason I bring the offering is I looked in the water, I saw my beauty, and I had thoughts of how I could manipulate that beauty to get others, seduce people, or whatever it might be. And immediately I recoiled and realized I've gone wrong. This is something. So I made the Nazirite vow. He said, we need people like you. This is a beautiful thing. But notice when he looked at the reflection, he only saw himself. And any relationship he would therefore enter into would be self-serving, exactly like the golden calf. We explained last week why the golden calf, I'm not going to go repeat the whole thing now. If you haven't heard that show, you can hear that. The women in Egypt, Moshe thought very similarly. Yes, it was good outcomes. They had children, but it's self-serving, right? They were busy beautifying themselves to attract the husbands. And now Hashem says, no, when they looked in those mirrors, they didn't see themselves. They saw a couple. They saw both of them. And yes, in other words, their identity was not self. It was us. This is so profound. Somebody actually asked me literally this morning the following question. They were teaching somewhere and they were talking about this dilemma of giving, right? They were saying how, you know, quotes you have Dassler about chesed, about kindness to others, how you're motivated by care for the other person, and you're motivated by just your desire to give and connect. But the highest motivation is if you're motivated on a deeper level to also serve Hashem, right? Dveikus b'Hashem, connection to Hashem, be like Hashem. And somebody asked, well, isn't that more selfish? You want to be close to Hashem to serve you. So you're giving to someone else, you'll get something closer to Hashem. That's manipulating them or doing something nice to them maybe for your ulterior motive. Say, so, you know, what do I think? So here is one of the most profound teachings. I remember when I was in Shiva learning, I don't remember the source of it. I think it was Rav Moshe Stav who told us this, but I don't remember where he was quoting from. And he described the world like a tree. And imagine on a tree, every twig has its own consciousness and own identity. And each leaf is pushing and fighting and pushing and fighting. I want the sunlight and the photosynthesis. No, I want it, right? And we're in a very selfish world. And then some of these little twigs remember that they're part of a branch. You see something very similar to this, by the way, this principle in the introduction of Reb Shimon Shkop to the Shari Yosha. Very doesn't use the metaphor of the tree, but the same principle. There's a deepening of self. When we're in love with, when we have love with somebody or a family or group of people, it's like we're one. Their pain is my pain. Their pleasure is my pleasure because my identity includes them. You can go deeper and deeper into a kehillah, into a community. Go deeper to the whole of Klal Yisrael, the whole Jewish people. Go deep eventually to what the whole of Mashiach's going to be, the whole of humanity coming together. Go deeper to the whole of history. Right? I can do things in my life now that I care about others who aren't even in the world. But the deepest place in the whole tree is the root of the tree, the connection to the infinite creator of the universe, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and his love and will for the universe. So, you know, in English, we use words selfish versus selfless. Now, the word selfless is not a literally true word ever. A person can't do something without their self. The self is always there, right? You can say, no, but I want to do it because it's true. Well, then something inside you has to want to do what's true. But I want to do it because it's good. Something inside you has to want what's good. The real difference between selfish and selfless, it's always the self. Who is the self? If the self is just this body, then that's what we call selfish. If the self incorporates others, if that's our identity, right, then our self-actualization is their fulfillment. If our self includes the whole nation, then our self-actualization involves the service to the cloud, the service of the whole. If our actualization is all the way down to the core of creation, to Hashem himself, then everything we are is a vessel and vehicle for pure Dvar Hashem, for pure godliness, for pure ruchliness, for pure beautiful things to be in the world. So, of course, when that person then looks at somebody in pain in the world, they're not thinking about my relationship with Hashem, right? They're thinking right now about the pain of the other person, right? But they are on such a deep level of connection to the root of all existence, that they are literally giving, and the power and energy with which they give when they perceive their entire life as literally plugged in and connected, they are, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, they are the hands through which Hashem's hand can reach around that person. They become the voice through which Hashem can talk to that person. They become lit up as the vessel for giving. The Nazir who looked in the mirror and saw himself, however much he'd be in a relationship with somebody at that point, was a danger. Because since his identity is himself, he's just going to be using them for his own gratification. He might be very nice. He might give them back too. They might get gratified as well. Now he might treat them nicely or whatever. But ultimately, it's manipulating for himself. And Moshe thought that's what these mirrors were too. And that shouldn't have a place in the Mishnah. But Hashem says, no, no, no. These women were motivated by far more. They were motivated, first of all, when they looked in the mirror, they didn't see themselves. They saw themselves and their husband. And that's why they showed their husbands. And then within that context of us and our actualization, then they could attract their husbands and so on. And ultimately, their motivation was completely the Jewish people, but it was coming not from a need to activate. You see, you can activate yourself and work for the community because my ego needs this, that, and the other. But if what's really happening is you're deeper and deeper down the tree, our love is the identity, our connection, the identity, then our thinking about the community becomes for real. It's an identity with everybody else. They were thinking about future generations and ultimately they were thinking about Hashem. And in that context, it's the purest gift there can be. And that's the gift that will restore harmony in the home. And it's the gift that will purify the Kohanim before they go in. And that's why Moshe opens with Vayakel and Shabbos. I think Vayakel means we can't do this if we don't identify as one. Yes, everybody can technically give their gifts. Yes, everybody can have their plaque on the wall of where their gift goes. The artisans can produce it. We can produce a building without all being one. But we cannot produce a real house of God if we are not all one. But all one doesn't mean we all conform. You're great at gold, you're great at silver. Everybody now brings their talents to bear. And that's how we produce a house of God. And then Shabbos. Shabbos is the day we let go of control. Yes, we can produce a house of God. We have to know that we're not in control. Hashem, we're attached to you. You are the root of reality. You are the anchor point of our reality. We stop for a day and let you in. And then when we go out and do 6 days of work, it's in the context of doing your work. That's what we're doing. And this is just a bit of the idea, but that's why the Sedra now, it's not they just did what they were instructed. They gathered together. Each one got a nediva sliba. We have to describe how there arose in their heart these various feelings. And then we describe a building of the menorah, because a building of the menorah that came out of the arising of feeling and love and connection to one another is not the same as just saying they did what they were instructed to do. And this gives us some sense, at least, of why the Torah therefore structures the instruction, which is really important, the battle of the golden calf, which is going to be the whole defining struggle, and then how they actually overcame it. And all of a sudden, the ark they built was not just fulfilling an instruction, but something that emerged from that vayakel, that gathering together, and from that nidvas libo, the arising of the desire to give in their heart that came from all of that, shown to us by the incredible mirrors of identity that the women had, that showed the Jewish people already in the slavery in Egypt, the roots of what would eventually allow the house of God to come into the world. May Hashem help all of us to connect to each other, to connect in deep ways, to identify not just with this physical body, we've got to look after it and care for it, but not identify it as the center of our reality, but to identify with others, to identify with those we love, to identify with the whole Kehillah, the whole Klal Yisrael, the whole world, the whole will of Hashem. Make it our own, and then together be able to really gather together and build the house of Hashem in this world once again.